You are about to listen to my conversation with Lori Boltemeyer, the Christian Life Coordinator at The Baby Fold. What's The Baby Fold? Well, in brief summary, it's a massive foster care, special education, early childhood programming, and adoption support provider in Central Illinois. What's a Christian Life Coordinator, though, you ask? Well, we will learn that together. Lori is also a reverend, has a bachelor's degree in music education, a master's degree in music therapy and special education, and is an Asbury Theological Seminary Biblical Studies ordained deacon in the United Methodist Church. Lori, thank you so much for coming on today, and that's a very impressive resume you have.
It's my pleasure to be here, Paul. Thank you.
Yes, the pleasure is all mine. We're going to talk about The Baby Fold, of course, their schools, helping children deal with trauma and behavioral issues, and how God ties into it all, and hopefully much, much more. But first, before we begin this fantastic conversation, I'd like to take a quick moment to thank our beloved sponsors with these very short commercials. We'll play them all right now, one after another, and you can skip them, but I think there's some very interesting local commercials myself, and they might just inform you of the exact service provider that you desperately need. We've got a gym, an insurance provider, a pizza place, and a furniture store coming at you right now. So we'll be right back in just a couple of seconds. A couple of minutes, rather.
If you've been living with an aching back, debilitating imbalances, or any physical discomfort and just want to get back to living a fit and happy life, look no further than In Motion Fitness Center and Outpatient Therapy at Fairview Haven in Fairbury, Illinois. Our highly skilled therapy team will guide you through proven and effective exercises to help you regain your strength, movement, and mobility, all with our renowned level of love and care. Live your best life. Call our therapy team at 815-692-6724. To find out how we can serve you today.
Choosing insurance can be complicated and daunting. That's why you need to call Pam Deaton with Health Markets. Pam will help you with all of your insurance needs, including health, life, vision, dental, and disability insurance. She's consistently been one of Health Markets' top national agents over the years and continues to earn great reviews from her clients. If you or a loved one needs to find the right insurance plan, you're in the right hands with Pam. Call her at 309-287-2518 to see how she can help you today.
Fairbury Furniture in Fairbury, Illinois has added over 7,000 square feet to their showroom, and that means more selection for you. Why wait for your furniture? You can buy anything on the showroom floor and take it home today. So hop in the car and take the short drive to Fairbury Furniture, where customers love their selection, pricing, and their take-it-home-today power. So many Bloomington Normal residents have made Fairbury Furniture their favorite furniture store, just 26 minutes away in downtown Fairbury.
Hurry down to Fairbury Furniture, where the furniture rocks.
I love pizza, especially pizza from Marcelloni's Pizza in Fairbury, Illinois. Experience Marcelloni's Pizza and their famous cheese nuggets for an amazing price when you order today. If you call them up at 815-692-4602 between 4 and 5 p.m. and order a pizza, you will get the second pizza of equal or lesser value for free. Restrictions apply. You can even pick up that order after the 4 to 5 p.m. window and still get that happy hour discount. As a pizza connoisseur myself, I will proudly say that my favorite barbecue chicken pizza is from Marcelloni's, so check them out. 815-692-4602. Pick it up at 405 East Locust Street in Fairbury. They're open 7 days a week from 4 to 9 p.m.
All right, all right.
Okay, and we are back. This is the Paul Garcia Show. I'm talking to Lori Boltemeyer. So, Lori, did I miss anything major in that very brief biography of you?
No, that pretty much covers it. It's interesting that kind of my background and my path to the Baby Fold kind of reflects our history and the women who founded the Baby Fold. I could have never dreamed it. They couldn't imagine me, and I can't imagine them. But our paths are similar. The Baby Fold was founded in 1902, so we have just celebrated our 120th anniversary of ministry, which is phenomenal for any organization to last that kind of longevity is rare. But these women were amazing. They were nurses who were trained by a female doctor. Kind of let that soak in. 1902, to have a female physician, her name was Lucy Ryder Meyer. She trained these women to do nursing care for people who maybe would not have been able to receive medical care. We would describe these folks today as on the margins. This training school was in Chicago, and she would dispatch nurses into the streets to care for people who wouldn't be able to get in to see a doctor. And so they would care for those who needed medical care. And these nurses also attended seminary courses. They had a ministry background as well. Now, women could not be ministers in 1902.
They couldn't even vote.
Correct. But they did have seminary training at what became Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, exists today. So they were rather pioneers in their time. And so they had this professional nursing training with this ministry lens, and they did some of their training in Chicago, and then they were dispatched to different areas throughout Illinois. Our deaconess women were sent to the Deaconess Hospital here in town. Now, I'm sure many of your listeners have been to this hospital, the Deaconess Hospital in Bloomington. It has a different name now. It's called Carl.
Mm.
It's had many names over the years, Brokaw and Mennonite. I mean, it's been, you know, many, many names. But that was originally the Deaconess Hospital. And these ladies were nurses there. And now remember, these nurses with this ministry lens. So I'm going to just jump right ahead and call these nurses church ladies, because I am one. I wear that title proudly, so I'm going to just go there with them. These church ladies, and if you know church ladies at all, when they encounter a problem, they do something about it. They're just not going to stand by and let a problem sit. So the problem they encountered in their nursing work was that at that time, sometimes babies were abandoned in the hospital by an unwed mother who could not take that child home in 1902. Perhaps this was not even an option for her. Or a family that just could not care for another child. Whatever the situation was, they would leave the child in the hospital. Because back in that time, there's no foster care system. There's not a lot of systems in place to care for a child. And so they would leave the babies in the hospital. Well, these nurses with big hearts said, well, we know how to take care of babies. And we know nice families that could take the baby in. And so they took these babies home to their home that had been deeded to them by a woman. So the first estate gift to the baby fold was given by a woman. You see the trend here, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Strong women doing brave things. Brought the baby home to a home that they were to retire in. Church ladies never retire. So what could have been a nursing home became a nursery. They took the babies home, cared for them, and found them families. So here's how kind of this early adoption was born. And this home became nicknamed a baby fold, like a sheep fold, but with babies in it. Get it? So that's how this name was born. It refers to Jesus as the Good Shepherd, providing safety and security for his sheep, which is us. But that became just a very sweet name for the children that were brought into the care of this home, care of these women, who then found them homes initially through the church, but, you know, very quickly expanded so that that's kind of the birth of adoption and the birth of our ministry, the Baby Fold.
Wow. And that was right here in Bloomington Normal?
Right here in Bloomington Normal.
Incredible.
Yeah. And so it kind of became, as it became known, people then would bring babies to the baby fold, would bring babies to that little house. It was on School Street initially, right on campus near the hospital where Carl is now. I mean, it's all, if you can kind of picture that, all Uptown Normal. And people would bring babies, literally those stories you hear of babies on the doorstep. Literally, that happened. This is also, Paul, the time, the era of the orphan trains that ran in our country from about 1880s to about 1920, right in that chunk of time. Right at that time, orphan trains were running from east to west across the country. They started in New York City, where children who were just sort of languishing on the streets of New York, literally orphaned, would just be in horrible, dire straits in the cities, the railroads would pick them up and put them on the trains and carry them westward. Now, why would the railroads care about that? Because they had a vested interest in creating families. Because when there are families, there are towns. Where there are towns, there is commerce. Where there's commerce, there's need for railroads. So the railroads would pick up the children and carry them cross country. So they would make these stops along the way. They were advertised through the paper that the orphan trains are coming to your town. And it was, I mean, just almost cringeworthy, right. Because people would gather. It was an event. The orphan trains would stop at your little town, and the people would gather to see the children who would pile off the train. And they would line the kids up by height. And if the child knew a poem or a song or a little dance, they would do it.
No.
It's kind of cringeworthy today to think about that, right? But but they were in very dire straits. It was their only chance, really. But they would kind of line them up and perform, and families would choose a child. Now, I often ask guests, you know, that I tell this story and I ask them, you know, who do you think got picked first? And very often people would say, well, the babies. They choose the babies first, but that's not the case. They would choose the oldest children, the tallest children, the oldest boys would be chosen first because they can work the farm. The oldest girls could help with housework and childcare. So the oldest children would be chosen. What was left on the train by the time it got to the Midwest, by the time it got to Illinois, were babies and toddlers, minority children, children with disabilities. Those were what was left on the train. Well, bless those children who made it to the stops where the deaconesses were waiting. Our deaconesses had open arms saying, well, welcome to the fold. Come on, little one, welcome to the fold. And they took them all in and were happy to take those. So that's kind of fed the baby fold as well. They were happy to take those. And Paul, it's so interesting. If you come to visit the baby fold, we've got wonderful pictures of those very early years. And I love that our ladies, I don't know who had the smarts to think about this, but we've got pictures of those very early days because it wasn't easy to get a photograph in the early 1900s. They didn't reach into their purse and pull out their iPhone and snap a picture. They had to go get some man to get a big camera, you know, contraption to get a picture. But we've got pictures of children of different ethnicities and different cultures sitting down at a meal together. And Paul, back in that time, that was scandalous to have a child with different abilities playing together.
Was it really?
Oh, my goodness.
Among children, not just adults.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Yes. Very just scandalous. And people would whisper about those Methodist women and what are they doing? That's not right. That's not right. And our women were like, are you kidding me? These are God's children. Of course they belong. Of course they have a place. Of course they're, I mean, it's sort of our sweet spot. Of course. So I'm just so grateful that we have documentation that somebody was thinking, we hear the whispers. This is the right thing to do. And by golly, let's capture it on film. I think that's brilliant. I don't know who to give that credit to, but God bless that woman who thought, let's not only do it, it's the right thing to do, but let's get a picture of it. So we have those pictures blown up in our hallways. You know, we want to just capture that because it's, you know, it's not like a point of pride for us, but it's like, golly, let's put that love on display. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, something that we just feel good about. So anyway, that's just kind of where we're coming from.
What a rich history,
it
though.
Is.
So rooted in Christ, too.
It is, absolutely.
In women. That's actually kind of unbelievable. Before they could vote, they were doing this amazing work that was so difficult and not rewarding in the ways that, you know, when you pick up an old older, taller boy that can work the farm, you immediately get the rewards. A baby can't do anything for you.
That
it completely relies on you.
Yes.
So it is totally out of the goodness of your heart that these women would take on this responsibility.
Right.
That's what it is. It's a huge responsibility. It's a lot of work, and you don't really get anything but the satisfaction in your heart of knowing that you're helping this person in need, this child in need, and pleasing God, which these are not tangible things.
That's right.
So these women must have really been special.
They were incredible. And I mean, think about it. There were no Pampers, no air conditioning. I mean, think about the rustic conditions back in the day for everybody. But wow, this was hard, hard work. And they did it with love. Incredible. And with a lot of community partnership. You know, they would go to Uptown Normal, to the grocers, and collect food. There's not a lot of refrigeration going on back then, too. I mean, we're still with ice blocks, et cetera. And so food needed to be consumed. So the town was very generous. The church ladies, different churches in the community, would bring canned goods to the baby fold. They'd can their beans and applesauce and so on and bring it for the kids. I was at a church. I speak at different churches nearly every Sunday. I have the blessing of have an invitation to go, and I speak. And I was there. I was at a small church in southern Illinois not too long ago, and this quite elderly woman caught me after the service, and she said, "Oh, I remember going to the baby fold as a little girl." And I said, "Oh, you visited?" And she said, "Yes, my brother and I came up to the baby fold. We visited, and we brought food." I said, "Oh, that's lovely." I said, "Tell me about that. Do you remember what you brought?" And she said, "Oh, yes." And I said, "Did you bring canned goods? Because so many people, you know, they hand, you know, the homemade canned pickles or whatever, you know." And she said, no, it wasn't canned goods." I said, "Well, what did you bring?" And she said, "Pigeons." And I said, Oh, really? And she said, "Yes, we shot them and brought them up for the children." Oh, thank you, ma'am. But she's probably telling the truth.
And then what, they cooked them?
I guess.
Never heard
it's
of squab. Such a thing.
Well, I guess. But, you know, back in the day, I don't know. But I thanked her kindly for that. Thank you, ma'am.
That's incredible. Wow. Is there a bit of honor that you have in being a deacon yourself? And what percentage of these women were, you call them deaconesses. First of all, is that the technical term for you since you are a female deacon? Are you a deaconess?
They say deacon. They just say deacon now.
Okay. Yeah. Unisex term.
There. I think, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And were they all ordained deacons, or understanding
they
it wrong?
They didn't have an ordination at that time. A modern-day deacon, I'm a member of the clergy. So nowadays in the United Methodist Church, you can be a deacon or an elder. We both go to seminary. It's a parallel path. Elders are called to ministry within a church. They lead a church congregation. They do their work inside church walls. Deacons are called to ministry in the same way, but they do their work outside church walls typically. A deacon is called to bridge an area of need in the world to a church. So the area of need that I am called to is the baby fold, is working with children and families with trauma history, and connecting that to the church. Okay, so I've got kind of a foot in both worlds with the baby fold and that area of need and the United Methodist Church. So I'm constantly trying to make sure that the church knows about my kids and families, and the kids and families know about the church and what it stands for. So I'm not trying to, with my clients at the baby fold, I'm not trying to be the church for them. I'm not trying to make them go to church. I'm not trying to make the baby fold be the church for them, but I'm making sure that they know about each other. That makes sense. Sort of bridge between the two.
Yes.
And then always making sure that the church knows about the needs of the baby fold as well. And then making sure the community knows about the needs of the baby fold as well. So I kind of walk in all of those worlds.
Do you feel a sense of responsibility or pressure even in following in the lineage of these great women since you're in the same position they are just a century plus later? Do you feel like there's pressure or just honor in trying to live up to maybe their standards or continue in their footsteps in an honorable way?
I do. I have such respect for them. I mean, man, the task they undertook. And they couldn't have possibly known how big this was going to get. They could not have imagined the scope of the baby fold today. I mean, we serve 1,200 kids a year now. We're in 28 counties in Illinois. I mean, they could not have imagined it. It would have blown their minds. God only reveals so much. You know, he'll show you just the next step. It would have freaked them out. It would freak us out if we could see what will be in 10 years, you know? Mm-hmm. So we're just so much larger than they could have envisioned. But I do, I feel the, I don't want to say pressure of it, but I the honor of it. I feel the... I have such respect. I want to live up to their heart that they had, their passion that they had, and want to keep the baby fold moving forward like they did. Hmm. Yeah.
So let's talk about what you do at the baby fold today. As I said in the introduction, you are the Christian life coordinator at the baby fold. What's that mean? What's an average day look like for you in that line of work?
That's kind of funny because every day is different for me, and my job has evolved over the years. I'm in year 36 at the Baby Fold. I started out as a teacher, and so my job will never be there's no way to I don't know how to describe this. My job has evolved so much over time that my job description will die when I do because it's been cobbled together. But to answer your question, part of my day is spent in development work, working with donors, helping to share our stories and inspire people to apply their passions to our work. Their assets to our work and just kind of link up their passion and interests with investing in the work of the Baby Fold. So that's part of my job. Public relations is certainly part of that, making sure that people understand what we do. If you understand what we do, if I can do that well, people will invest in our work. And I say it this way in church circles, if I can get in your heart, God will get in your wallet. Yeah. I don't have to ask about money. If I can really do my job well and really sharing in a sincere way, in an honest way, what we do, and you love what we do like I do, if I can do that in a good way, it's up to God to, inspire your heart and your wallet. I don't really have to deal with that. I think giving is a spiritual thing anyway. So I don't really have to go there and kind of beg you for money. Never have, never will. That's not how this works. That's just kind of a misunderstanding. That is not how this works. If you have a passion for our work and I can build a relationship with you around that, then you're just going to want to do that. And I don't have to ask about that at all.
That's a great way it comes
out of it.
Yeah, and you're completely right. In the few things, I'm not some donation machine. Maybe one day I will be.
Yeah.
But the things that I do donate to or sponsor, they are things that they didn't ask me to sponsor.
Right.
I'm just like, hey, can I support you guys?
Uh-huh.
Can I do something to help? Because I love what you do.
That's right.
It's important, and I want to be a part of it.
That's right.
That's kind of your strategy.
Totally. The work speaks for itself. It's not about me. It's the work. If I can describe to you well how this family has transformed, how this child's life has changed. If I can describe that well, and that touches your heart, and you want to see that happen for the next kid and the next kid and the next one, all right, invest. Do it, because that's the right word. It's an investment, because your money keeps growing. It doesn't just not, it's not a one and done. It keeps going. So that's something, who doesn't want to do that? That's awesome.
So your official title, as I said, on the website for the Baby Fold is Christian Life Coordinator. It lists a few other responsibilities that you hold as well.
Right.
But it says Christian.
Yep.
So therefore, the Baby Fold must be proudly or not ashamedly
correct
Christian.
It is.
That said, what is the Baby Fold's mission? I know they have the schools. They have the adoption agency, the foster care agency, the early childhood development programming. What do they want to do? What is their core mission that ties these things together?
Right. Yes. Let me touch one more piece on my job description just to fill in the last piece of that, and then I'll go to our mission statement. Because I also provide pastoral care for children, their families, and even our staff. So that's another piece of my job is as a child or family opts in for pastoral care, I don't automatically go to them, knock on their door and say, hey, let me talk to you about your spiritual life. There's an assessment when a client comes into care in all of our, if it's a foster family, adoptive family, intact family, whatever program they're in, there's an opportunity for them to opt in for pastoral care. Do you think this will be helpful to your treatment? Yes, no. If they say yes, then I start a relationship with them. I'll meet with them. If they say no, then I leave them alone. Because again, I'm not the church. I'm not trying to be the church for them. But if they say yes, then I can meet with them. And I'm also available to our staff who sometimes just need to sit down and have some pastoral care. And I'm happy to do that. I've got a nice private office and everything's confidential and let's just sit down and talk. And so that's meaningful as well.
What kind of counsel do you give them, being that you are giving pastoral care? Mm-hmm. Are you giving them God-centered advice? Are you mm-hmm. saying to them what you think? This is one thing mm-hmm. that I've always gotten, and maybe mm-hmm. it's the man in me. It seems like men have kind of a difficulty with this type of thing. When mm-hmm. people say, God spoke to me, God told me this, yeah. if he told you something, that's amazing. Like, yeah. what's that mean, he told you something? I mean, you have a feeling and you can mm-hmm. kind of piece it together and think that this is probably what God wants. Mm-hmm. What do you tell these people if, in fact, the advice you give is God-centered and you're mm-hmm. trying to determine what God might want for you? Because ideally, that's your will is God's will. What God wants, mm-hmm. you want. So let's figure out what he wants. I'm running all over the place with this. What do you tell them and how does it sound?
I rarely use the phrase, God told me this, if that's what you're asking. I mean, if someone, you know, brings a question, a problem, and, you know, I try to base my advice or counsel on just wisdom from Scripture, wisdom from experience, and listening carefully to what they're telling me. And one of the questions I have in my head often is, what does love require here? You know, and listen to, again, very carefully what they're telling me and listening for what's the underlying hurt here. Because God is always looking to heal. And there's usually a pain underneath some problem. Jesus is the healer and he's looking to heal and he's looking to forgive. So there's usually a sin or a wound that is looking for forgiveness or healing. And so, you know, I don't ask them to name it because that's hard to do and maybe none of my business, right? But I ask them to explore that because we come at sins and wounds the same way. I got kind of off on a tangent here a little bit. But
oh, please. That's what podcasts are for.
Okay.
Continue.
A little bit of a tangent here. But I think the reason that we get them mixed up is because we act the same way. We have the same response to a sin or a wound. This goes back to the garden. Okay? Again, here we go on a tangent.
Your theological education mm-hmm. is showing.
Coming through, okay?
Love it. I love it.
Well, because, and here's where my years of experience with kids comes through, because I hear so often, especially children, but adults too, say, that was my fault. My parents' divorce was my fault. That was my fault. And they're taking responsibility for something that is not theirs. Okay? They feel like that was a sin. I need to be forgiven for something that happened that is not on them, right? So sins and wounds are mixed up. And so, but I think that's been happening since the garden, because the response to a sin is to hide. When the fall happened, when Adam and Eve, the fruit was, you know, dripping off their chins, right? Their first response was to hide in the bushes, right? They ran from God and they hid. And that's what we do. When we sin, we want to make sure nobody sees that. We hide that stuff and things get crazy in the hiding of it, right? We want to just make sure nobody finds out about that. Mm-hmm. Hope nobody mm-hmm. sees that. We'll do all kind of things to cover our tracks, right?
Yeah.
And we do the same thing when we're hurt. When we're wounded, we also step back and hide. Hey, how you doing, Paul? I'm fine. But you're not. We will lie to someone's face. We are crushed inside. Something's really, you know, wrong. We will not admit that. We're going to put on a face and hide our real feelings, right? So when we're wounded, we also hide. And that's when it gets kind of mixed up. And because our response is the same. And but the remedy is the same. We have to reveal it. We've got to come out of hiding.
Yeah.
We've got to expose our wounds. We have to expose our sin to God so that we can receive healing or forgiveness. And so it's hard to get that straight. And both things are hard. Both things are hard. It's hard to say, ooh, I was wrong. I'm sorry. That's a hard thing. It's equally hard to say, ouch, I'm hurting, and let someone touch something that hurts. It's really hard. I've told this story before about, it just brings back a childhood memory of me crashing on my bike and just laying my knee open, skinned knee, bad, gravel in it. Remember the old gravel? You're probably too young. Gravel driveways?
Sure.
Oh, my gosh. Brutal, right? We're just crashing off on my bike and just, you know, laying my knee open and running into the house and hiding from my mother, because if she sees this bloody knee, she's going to come at me with the mercurochrome, the red stuff. Remember the red stuff that's got alcohol? Oh, so painful. And so I'm hiding this wound from my mom because she's a good mom. And if she sees this, she's going to apply that painful medicine. So I remember going into my bedroom and shutting the door and hiding from her and trying not to cry and let her hear me cry. But she, you know, comes in the room because she's a good mama. And she's, Lori, honey, let me see. And I'm covering it up and I'm covering up and blood's running down my leg and I'm, don't know, mommy, no. She's like, honey, let me see. I'm crying. She's like, let mommy see, honey. I finally, you know, let her see it. She goes, okay. She goes and she gets the washcloth and she brings the medicine. And she wipes it off gently and she puts the medicine on. But she's a good mama, so what does she do? Blows on it. Blowing on it, blowing it. Gets me to blow on it, too. Helps you stop crying. Puts a little Band-Aid on it. Kisses the tears off my cheeks.
Oh.
Puts me on my feet and sends me back outside. But I had to reveal it to her first. Yes, it's painful, but she can bring the remedy then, okay? So we have, there's this revealing that has to happen before we can get the healing, right?
Receive the adequate care that we need.
That's right.
To no longer be in pain.
That's right.
And sometimes that's so scary.
Very.
To walk through those flames necessary to purify you.
That's right. That's right. And that's what we're asking our baby fold kids and families to do, too. They've got to trust us to go through that process with us, to come out of hiding, to be real, and trust us to bring healing to them. Because that's what we're offering. And we've got to do it in a very different way than maybe it's been done before. If a family is receiving services from us, it's not because things are going well. You know, and they've been through some stuff. Whether it's foster family, an adoptive family, a child in one of our schools, kid with either a trauma history or behavioral emotional problems, a child with autism. I mean, regardless of what the situation is, life is tough and it's been hard and the world's been hard on them. You know, it's just been difficult. And so we've got to approach them with some tender, loving care and with some hard messages. Sometimes things need to change, but we've got to come at them with compassion and with empathy or nothing's going to change. If when I'm in there with my bloody knee, if my mom had barged in the room with the medicine and just thrown it at me and, you know, held me down and poured the medicine on my knee, I would not, you know, that would not have gone well, right? But she knew the careful way to do it. And it's one of the things I think the baby fold does best are people just are able to sit down with a family at their table, not ours. All our work is done in the home. Even our school kids have a family advocate who goes into their home. So we go to their home and do the work. Sit at their table, sit down, and here's the key thing, Paul. We sit down and shut up and listen. Just listen to their story. Don't go in there blasting about what they need to do and what needs to change and what they've done wrong. No. Just sit and listen with respect and hear their story. I'll often use the phrase, teach me about your child. Because even though I've got 36 years of experience and I've read the file and I probably know exactly what's going on, no, I really don't. Not really. And how insulting to go in and presume I know about your child. How awful. I mean, that's awful. So we go in and just listen for strengths of the family, because they all have them. Listen for what they're doing right. Listen what strengths they have, strategies they have, and start there. Let's build from there.
I like that.
And see what we can do from their blueprint. And then let's shape that together. It's a very different model than what they've experienced before, than somebody just calling them up and saying, well, here, so-and-so's in trouble, and this is the consequence, and here, you know, let's do it differently. Let's do it together.
What you're saying, going in there and revealing their strengths and building off of that is the exact opposite of what Satan is, which is the accuser.
Yeah.
You're bad, man. You really messed up.
That's right.
And then you go back to the garden to kind of tie this all together.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
He hides. Adam hides because he feels guilty. Because And then there's this shame within him now. This, you messed up bad. You better hide.
That's right.
You better hide. It's just like you felt you better hide when you had your knees all skinned up.
That's right. The garden is the first episode of Naked and Afraid, if you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, right?
You know what else, though? And this is, maybe I disagree with you a little bit
Go ahead.
So you're not big on having the people that come to you for counsel confess anything. Mm-hmm. Now, shocker here, I am Catholic.
Yeah.
Right. You know about confession.
I do.
We like to think about, and I love the garden. There's so much information in the garden, so much about human nature. Mm-hmm. So, yes, Adam eats the apple. He goes into hiding. He knows he's naked. He knows he messed up. Mm-hmm. And God, of course, being all-knowing and omnipotent, he sees everything. He knows Adam's hiding. But what's he do? He doesn't say, Adam, get out here. He says, where are you?
That's right.
Why does he say, where are you? He doesn't, he knows where he is. Yeah. Why does he ask him where he is? It's so he confesses.
That's right.
Here's the thing. When you confess, you release a weight that was bearing down on you. And I'm sure you've noticed that, and you understand this well, sometimes bearing the weight of an untold story is an unnecessary torture.
Right.
That all it needs is just to relieve itself on a listening ear. So God has him confess. And I look at that as the first confession.
Yeah.
And then later, Christ, why does he do this? He dies, and then he comes back, and the apostles are up in the upper room. They're hiding. They're scared. They're being persecuted. Christ walks through the door, so you know it's important.
Yeah.
Through the door, not through the open
right,
door.
Right.
He goes through it like a ghost. He freaks them all out.
Right.
Thomas puts his finger in his side. He says, yes, it's me. Then he breathes on them, the Holy Spirit, presumably. And then he says, and Catholics love this, confess your sins to one another.
Yeah.
Or, whosoever sins you retain, they are retained. Whosoever sins you forgive, they are forgiven them. Basically, go and do this. And from that moment on, Catholics have been hearing confessions.
Yes.
And we think there's and also we should say, these aren't normal old people in the Catholic tradition. These are priests. They are acting in persona Christi. They're in the person of Christ. Christ's not here in the flesh right now. These people, through the authority given to them through Christ, in being a priest, they hear your confessions. It's the best we got. But, you know, it's what we do. They don't forgive your sins. It is God through them forgives your sins. Anyway, why do we even forgive those sins? Well, it's not like Jesus was just being a psychologist saying, this is good for you. It makes you feel better. Trust me. But also, there is a healing grace that flows into you, into your soul, through this act of confessing verbally. And when you confess verbally, what Catholics say is that denies you your pride, because you can't go tell your sins to someone and confess what you did without first disregarding your pride and doing away with it.
Right.
So, you know, the Holy Spirit and immense pride, they can't live together.
That's right.
One's got to leave before the other can come in. You know, so just that's, I guess that's my disagreement with you. And maybe you tell me what you think. I think there's great power in confessing, but maybe that's not your job. Maybe that's the job of a therapist.
Yeah, that's I would say it's probably not my job. It does happen, but that's not my goal, is to be someone's confessor. You know, if that happens, that's great, and I'm happy to hear that and apply grace to that. And again, forgiveness through Jesus, you know, that absolutely agree with, I agree with you on that. And, you know, the grace of God is free to all, and, you know, bring it on, bring it on. And yeah, absolutely. But that's not my goal when they come in, that I'm not trying to be anyone's confessor. I don't want my office to feel like a confessional. Because that can be pretty heavy and difficult for people to come in and do that. I want them to feel a little bit more relaxed, to be able to just come in and kind of talk things through. It may come to that, which is great, but I don't want it to feel that way, if you know what I mean, unless they need it to be.
Right.
Depends on the person and the situation.
Right.
So, yeah.
So you work with a lot of kids, and I don't know the adjective to use to describe them without being too offensive. Are they troubled kids? Are they're kids that have a proclivity to get into trouble. That's for sure. Let me ask you this. Let me step back. Why do you do that? Why do you choose to work with these kids? I know a lot of teachers who say their jobs are immensely difficult in just a normal old public school, even a private school. You choose to work with the most difficult kids to work with. For lack of a better term. Why do you do that?
Kids from hard places is one of the phrases that we use. That kind of takes it off of them and places it into, like, their environment. You know, they come from hard places because it's not just about their behavior. We're always looking past behavior to the why behind the behavior. Every behavior has a why. Why is the child having this behavior? What's going on in the child's life that's causing this behavior to happen? We're always looking at the why behind it. So this bratty behavior, this, you know, tantrumy behavior, this, you know, bad behavior, there's air quotes all over all of that, right? That this child is having, what is it that's making this child want to have this acting out behavior? That's what we're looking at, okay? So that brings compassion to it. Okay, there's a reason that this child is still at the age of 9 having 3-year-old tantrums. An older child who looks like a 3-year-old kicking and screaming on the floor, that's not normal. What's going on? There's a question to be asked there. Why is that happening? We want to look at the why. So sometimes it's as simple as the kid's hungry. There's something else. Okay, so there's a lot of kids. There's a lot of kids who live with poverty and food insecurity. And this hangry thing, oh, that's real. We joke about, oh, I'm hangry, you know, so hungry that you're mad. We joke about it. That is a real thing, Paul, and it's way too prevalent, even in our community, where it gets wired together, even as babies that don't get fed regularly. What fires together, wires together in the brain. So even in infancy, if the child is not fed regularly, it starts to connect hunger and anger together. So when a child feels hungry, they feel mad. And that stays with them. So you get a kid who at 10 o'clock, you'll hear a complaint from a teacher. Every day at 10 o'clock, this kid has a meltdown over nothing. Can't share a toy, you know, just can't, blah, 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 you know, for no reason. This kid has, you know, got behavior problems every day. You know, 10 o'clock, this kid just having a fit about something. What a brat. Every day, you say? 10 o'clock? Does the kid have breakfast? Well, I don't know. Oh, well, you know, about 10 o'clock, if I don't have breakfast, I'm hangry too. You know, give the kid an apple. Let's see if that doesn't resolve the behavior problem. It wasn't behavior. And I'm not, let me back up real quick and say I'm not criticizing teachers, okay? They got way too much to do. But you know what I'm saying? That so easy to just say it's a behavioral issue when really it's something deeper than that. It's hunger. it's poverty. It's something else going on that kind of gets labeled as a behavioral issue. Okay? So lots of kids watching the clock, waiting for lunch to get there. Waiting for lunch because they didn't have breakfast. So we make sure the baby fold, well, we serve breakfast to every child. They can refuse it if they don't need it, but every child gets offered breakfast. And any child can have food whenever they want. It's not a Snickers bar, but it's an apple or something. If you're hungry, and we make sure kids know that, especially when they're new, if you're hungry, let us know. You don't have to, you know, do anything crazy to get food.
It seems like peace in your behavioral temperament is a privilege you can only enjoy if your base necessities are met.
Absolutely.
You're not hungry.
Right.
You have shelter.
Mm-hmm.
These things.
You slept well last night.
You slept well.
You feel safe. All of it. And that's such a challenge right now, Paul, with our community. Let me just make it that big. But our babyfold families are struggling so much right now. Those who were near the poverty line have slipped below it, just with our economic issues right now and rent issues right now are just really pushing our families hard. It is difficult. Our working poor are really struggling. It's tough because we've got to meet those basic needs, food, shelter. I mean, just make sure people have a roof over their head. It is really hard right now. People trying to stay housed. We're having to support people just at that level. Make sure they've got food. Make sure they've got rent money, utility money. Because you're right, those basic needs have to be met, or nothing goes further.
And when it comes to assisting these families with their utility mm-hmm. needs, their rent needs, I believe you told me that it's not you give the families the money and then hope that they pay the rent. It's more like you pay the rent
mm-hmm.
or part of the rent
mm-hmm.
directly.
Right, right.
There's no chance of any scandalous activity going on, reusing this money in a different way, shape, or form.
Right, right.
It's none of that.
Right.
And which people that donate to you should like to hear.
Sure. Sure. And we work so closely with our families. It's not like we don't know them or we're not meeting with them regularly or anything that, you know, the baby fold is very trustworthy and we work closely with our families too. So there's really no risk of that. We're not just handing cash out or, you know, anything like that. We know and trust our families and they are, God bless them. They are working so hard. There's only so many hours a day you can work and still have a relationship with your child,
mm-hmm.
you know, and still, you know, you were trying to balance all of that out. They want to be good parents too, and we want them to be good parents. So how many hours can you work and still have a healthy relationship with your child?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just, and how many times can the rent go up and still keep that apartment? You know, and we've got a housing crisis here in town. So we're really trying to step up and help them be the best employee they can be and the best parent they can be and the best person they can be and just try to, you know, get them through this really tough time right now. And our community has been doing that. We just had a successful festival. I mean, our community steps up.
The Festival of Trees,
yeah,
the premier giving event of Bloomington Normal.
Good
annual.
Times. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, it was good.
When you say the housing crisis, for
yeah.
people that don't know, what is the housing crisis in Bloomington Normal?
Yeah, I can't speak to that with a lot of detail, but I just know that there's just a shortage of affordable housing. Rent has continued to escalate. There's just not enough affordable homes or apartments in town. There's just not enough. The numbers are too low, and so people are just being squeezed out of affordable apartments, and it costs so much more to if you get behind in your rent, can't stay in your apartment, to find another one and start over is so much more expensive. First month's, last month's rent, all of that is so much more expensive than just staying in.
Uh-huh.
So we're trying to help people stay in. You know, don't get behind in your rent. Don't, you know, just stay put, stay in that same zip code. Stay in the same daycare, your kid in the same school, you know, all that to stabilize where you are is so much better for a family than having to be moving around all the time.
Right.
So we're just trying to help stabilize.
It's so scary because that can happen to people, and it's not like these people aren't working.
That's right.
These people are working.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
If you made, you know, $1,200 in a month, if you're a server or something, first of all, you're going to have to work a lot to get $1,200 a month. And say you're a single mom and you're doing that. You only have so many hours a day until kid comes home.
That's right.
And you might have to work while your kid's at home in order to make the $1,200. And then rent is $600. And then food is $400. And then you're at $1,000. You have $200 left over. It's not like you don't have other bills to pay. Utilities are $300. Boom, you're negative.
I know.
You can't work anymore.
I know.
What the heck are you supposed
to do?
Sell your body? What are you going to do?
I know.
It's crazy.
It's rough. I know.
It's crazy. And that can happen to someone who's working.
That's right. That is happening to people who are working. So it's not, you know, we don't have people laying on their couches, you know, doing nothing and complaining. They're working and working and working.
I love that because I wouldn't expect anything different from you in your personal advice giving because you think of Jesus. Look, isn't it funny how you can look to the Bible and the gospel specifically for guidance on what you should do and how you should act? One thing I don't like is when people say, just give them the money, give them the money. You don't need to work, don't need to work. That's sympathy that's run amok. Because what does Jesus do to even the beggar who can't move his legs? He says, get up and carry your thing and
that's
go here.
That's right.
He does not say, here. He doesn't throw money at him. He makes him work.
I know.
And you want to work when you think about it. Someone wants to work.
I think that...
they want to earn it. You
that's
know?
Right. That's right. I think that was one of the signals when he heals the paralytic. I think that's one of the things he's saying to the whole crowd, not just to that man, but when he says, pick up your mat, that is a sign of work. Because that's a sign of breaking the Sabbath. If you pick up your mat, you're breaking the Sabbath because you're working. So that was a big signal to that crowd in that day is that's work. Pick up your mat to them means work. And so he said, because he could have walked away without that mat. He didn't need it. He didn't need it anymore. It could have been a sign of, ooh, you don't need it anymore. Leave it right here. Walk away from that mat. He could have said that. Walk away from your mat. That would have been kind of dramatic and cool. But he didn't. He said, pick it up. Pick up that mat. And so I think he's saying intentionally, you can work now, buddy, and I expect you to. You're part of the workforce now. And how happy he must have been, this paralytic who couldn't work, to be part of the workforce. Yes, I'll pick that up, and I'm happy to, because now I'm an employer. I'm an employee. I can work now. So I think that was part of the message. Jesus is saying, hey, dude, you're healed. Now get to work.
Right.
So I think, you know, it's just part of that.
And if you try to attain a good quality of life and somehow dodge work, it's just impossible. It's written in the code of humanity again, the garden.
The garden, yeah.
It is by the sweat of your brow that you will live to the man.
Yeah.
Good luck getting out of it.
Yeah.
You can't. You can think you can. You can even inherit all this money. What happens to people who inherit money and don't work? They become weird people, and things get bad.
Yeah.
You can't run from it. This is the law of the land.
We're supposed to,
as told by the lawgiver. But, okay, so you're obviously, we're talking about Jesus so much. You're very religious. Have you ever had your faith tested?
Oh, Lord.
Or even... lost it?
Good question.
A bit personal. I hope that's okay.
Okay. No, I can't think of a time I've actually lost it. It's been tested, of course. You hope your faith is tested. I think doubt is healthy. I think testing is healthy. Certainly, your faith needs to be stretched or it won't grow. I think if it's never tested, stretched, pushed, is it growing then? Is it alive? I was thinking about this because this time of year, and again, this is personal, so I hope it's not boring to your listeners. This time of year, I'm thinking about my mom who's gone. She's with Jesus now too, and both my parents are. But mom was hit by a car. Many years ago, pedestrian versus car. So she did not come out well. She survived it, but she was very seriously injured. And it was tragic for our whole family, certainly for her. There was, I remember we got to the hospital. A surgeon said, I'm trying to remember the quote exactly, but he said, I've never seen so much trauma on a living body. I thought, you know, is she going to make it? And they gave no promises that she would survive this thing. I mean, she was hit by a car. I mean, she lost a leg. I mean,
how old was she?
She was 65.
Ooh.
So, I mean, just horrific injuries, head injury, just horrific injuries. It was just devastating. And so, you know, didn't know whether to pray that she live or die. Really didn't know how to pray for that. But is it better that she just go? Because the recovery from this is going to be horrible. And that's what they were telling us. And it was just a really, really tough time for our whole family. It was terrible. And I remember hearing very well-intentioned friends saying, well, there but by the grace of God go I. And I've heard that before, you know. And I heard them say that, and it hit my ears differently, and I thought, well, what are you saying? That the grace of God was not on my mother because she was hit by a car? You know, it shook me, and I thought, well, that's ridiculous. She was a deep woman of faith. Are you kidding me? That's a terrible thing to say, you know? But it shook me. And I remember sitting in that intensive care waiting room thinking, well, Lord, what is this? Why was she hit like that? I mean, you could have held back that car. You could have, you know, 1 second here or there, you know, you could have prevented this. Why? Why did this, you know, that kind of why, God, why moment, you know? And I remember thinking, well, is your grace sufficient for this? Is it? You know, the word says your grace is sufficient for everything. My grace is sufficient. Well, is it? Is it for this? Is it big enough for this? And I just had to sit there and absorb that. Is it? Well, yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. Either it is or it was a yes or no question, you know? Either God is big enough for this or not. And he is faithful, and he is. But that was kind of I had to stop and think about it for a second, because it just seems so, wow. It was so deep, and it was so hard. But I've thought back on that many times. Yes, he is big enough. His grace is big enough. Even if she had passed away right then, big enough that we'd survived it. So, yeah. So, yeah, it's been tested. I have to lean into my faith a lot, often. But you lean into it. You either lean in or lean out, you know. Lean into it. And God is faithful every time. Mm-hmm. Faithful and every time.
Leaning into it can seem illogical to someone who's maybe an atheist.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, man, I really don't know, which is exactly why
I'm
going to say it's all yours and I trust you.
It's trust. That's right.
Trust is faith. Really?
Exactly.
It's, I don't know for sure, but I trust you.
That's
have
right.
faith in your significant other even. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know if you're going to go out and do this thing with your mm-hmm. friends, if you're going to cheat on me. I don't know, but I trust you.
Yeah.
I have faith in you.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing for sure eliminates the possibility for faith.
That's right.
And that's by God's design.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he just made himself known, like, here I am. See, I am real, completely mm-hmm. real. I'll shake mm-hmm. your hand right now.
Mm-hmm.
If he did that to us right now, it'd eliminate the faith.
Takes no faith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everything good takes, even love takes faith. Mm-hmm. I call it the law of love. I think love mm-hmm. exists it's this law that it exists all the way up to heaven type of a thing. It's love, in order to be true, you must not be sure, for sure, if it's going to be given back to you. It's like love is a giving thing. So if I'm going to love my girlfriend or my wife, I have to do so and just do it not knowing for sure that they're going to give it back. You can fall in love with someone who doesn't love you.
Mm-hmm.
Easy. And I don't know where I'm going with this exactly. But anywho, we're getting too theological for this baby fold. I guess it ties in, right? It's a Christian organization. Anyway, moving on to a few more things before we wind down this interview.
Yes.
I got a few things here. You know what? I'm going to skip this question. Just general advice, maybe. And I'll maybe ask you to share a story here if you can. When a child is freaking out, for again, mm-hmm. a lack of a better term, you know, maybe they're cursing at a teacher. They're just ridiculously angry for whatever mm-hmm. reason. Maybe it's they're hungry, like you mm-hmm. alluded to earlier.
Yeah.
Maybe they're throwing a chair, right? I've had friends that have gone to schools like the Hammett schools. And mm-hmm. maybe before you answer this question, you can tell us a little bit more about what Hammett schools are.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you deal with these kids when, for lack of a better term, a tantrum, a freak out, one of these episodes is occurring? What do you do what would you recommend doing as a teacher or maybe as a parent?
Mm-hmm.
So to summarize the question, maybe if you want to tell us what those Hammett schools do, yep. that what kind of schools they are, and then how do you deal with these episodes?
Sure. Let me tell you a little bit about the Hammett schools, just kind of in general. We cover preschool through high school in our three Hammett school locations in town. The door into Hammett School is through public school. So we accept referrals from about 40 school districts in the area, 60-mile radius around Bloomington Normal. So kids come in through public school referrals. So the public school has attempted to meet the needs of the children that we serve, but they're just not equipped to do it. And again, that is not in any way a criticism of public school. It's just that it's a more comment of the needs of the kids that need to come to Hammett. They're just too severe for what public schools are designed to do.
Could you give an example of mm-hmm. what they cannot provide?
Well, the one-on-one instruction that some of our kids need, that just to keep them safe and on track. The classes are just too big, and it's just too much for a teacher to try to keep eyes on a larger classroom, and we've got this kid that just really needs somebody to help them stay on track and regulated. So they're just not equipped to do it. So you can have the best teacher in the world standing in front of that classroom, but if this kid is that hangry kid who's going to throw a chair, you can't expect that best teacher in the world just cannot handle that and keep the classroom going. It's not fair to the rest of the kids. It's not fair to that teacher. It's just not what that classroom is designed for. So it's kind of just a mismatch there. So that school then, let's say that child is in Leroy Public School, just making that up, they make that referral then that this is not appropriate placement for this child. They can make the referral then to Hammett School, one of the Hammett schools, and if we deem that that's an appropriate placement, then we can take that child in. So the Leroy School provides transportation to Hammett. The funding for that child follows the child to Hammett. So we get some of our funding through Illinois State Board of Education for that child. So some of that funding comes that way. It's never going to be enough, so we're always fundraising because he's going to go into a classroom that's much, much smaller than what he just came from mm-hmm. at Hammett.
And very much tailored to meet their needs.
Yes,
that's the whole thing. It's specialized care.
Absolutely, with an individualized care plan for that child and also that family advocate that's working with the entire family.
Okay.
So that's a social worker that's going into the home and linking family and teacher and student all together. So they've got a whole team around that child. And again, we're not just treating the child, we're treating the whole family. Mm-hmm. So they're getting a lot more support than what the public schools can offer.
Okay. And just curious, mm-hmm. what percentage of the child's tuition needs, I'll call it, mm-hmm. does the Illinois State Board of Education cover on average?
I think it's about 80%.
80%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then how many kids, here's just a big question.
Yeah.
How much money do you guys need each year roughly to keep the lights on? The Baby Fold does a lot of things.
Yeah.
And you have volunteers, I know, but you mm-hmm. also pay people, as you should,
oh, yeah.
if you want them to do a great job.
Oh, yeah.
How much money do you guys need to operate on an annual basis to keep every single thing running?
Mm-hmm. We need to, if I'm understanding your question, we need to raise about $2 million every year to make our budget. So we've got a planned deficit every year. We know we're going to come up short about $2 million. So we need to raise about $2 million to fill in that gap between our funding resources and what it actually costs to make the Baby Fold run.
Hmm.
So
$2 million uh-huh. is an awful lot of money.
Uh-huh.
How do you who can I ask even mm-hmm. is this private information, who are mm-hmm. the biggest donors or who do you rely on the most? Are there certain events that are the biggest contributors? What contributes yep. to meeting that fiscal need?
It's individuals, it's businesses, it's people. That's the best way I can. It's people. It's people who care about us. It's that individual donor who has a heart for us. It's that person who has a farm who leaves estate gifts. It's, you know, someone who has had a love for children their whole life, or they've adopted many years ago, leaves, you know, a part of their estate bequest. It's that really amazingly, the timing is always just makes us smile. That just when we're thinking, oh my gosh, we're not going to make it. And then ding, little Mrs. So-and-so from little, you know, Smallville, Illinois, just passed away, and we never even knew, you know, maybe didn't even know her. And by golly, she didn't have big chunk of money set aside for the little ones at the baby fold, and here it comes just at the right time. It's just miraculous how these things happen. Or we have some farm income, and the crops just come in at just the right time, at just the right money. It's just kind of miraculous. But God takes care of us that way, by, again, placing the baby fold in people's hearts, and they make a legacy gift for us. It's just good. And plus our community partners and businesses and, you know, our sponsors to the festival are very generous. And just it's big and small gifts. You know, there's we have a donor that sent just this last month $3. He just sent $3. I'm like, how cute are you? Some, you know, we're doing a Christmas wish list right now. And there's a little gal who saves her allowance so that she can do, she can adopt a child for the wish list program. How sweet is that?
Wow.
That's what, to me, that's like kingdom money. And that gift right there is as big as the estate gift. You know, those are equal big gifts. You know, it's not $100,000, but dang, that's her allowance money.
Percentage-wise.
It is. Yeah. It's like, it's the same. That allowance money, so that she can buy the doll for the girl, you know, on the wish list, is the same.
That's a special little girl right there.
Dang, don't you know it, right? So, again, it's heart money, and it's all valuable, and yeah, it's amazing.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, well, I saw at the Festival of Trees, you guys, I hope it's okay to say it, you had some big sponsors. The more money you contribute, the bigger your sign, the bigger whatever you get. And Radio Bloomington gave I don't know if I could say it. I think you said like $20,000. That's awesome.
I know.
And it makes them look amazing too.
It does.
Yeah. So is it, do businesses contribute in when it comes to what types of donors, businesses, individuals, do businesses give the bulk, do you think?
And we were happy to do marketing for them, you know, because we just want to highlight them. Listen, here's our businesses in our town that care about our kids, and churches, and, you know, individuals who care about our mission, who want to see families be healthy and strong, and we're happy to highlight them, you know. And hopefully, if you haven't sponsored the festival before and you're listening right now and you'd like to be known in this town as people who care about our kids and families, step up next year, or, you know, reach out, you know, happy to do that, because it's good for everybody. It's a win-win-win. Everybody wins in that situation.
Right. Who were the big sponsors this year? I know Radio Bloomington comes
and
to
Sylvester
mind.
And Sylvester Dental.
That's right.
Yeah,
Sylvester
the other
Dental.
One. Yes. Bless their hearts. Yeah, they're great, great family. Mm. So yeah, there were our two big sponsors. So.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Back to the question about how to deal with those children from rough upbringings. What was it you said instead of
hard
troubled
places?
Hard places.
From hard places. What's going on when a child is kind of in that tantrum, and an adult as well, is that their brain is what we say dysregulated. They're not able to think clearly. They're literally in their what we would say is in their lower brain. And our children can actually describe lower brain. It means that you're kind of unable to access your reasonable thinking part of your brain, your upper brain, where you can clearly articulate what you're thinking, okay? So, like, when you're a baby and you just cry, that's all a baby can do, right? Wah, cry. They're hungry, they're wet, they're, you know, whatever. All they can do is meh, cry. That's it. It's all they've got. They cannot calm themselves. They can't help themselves, right? So when a baby cries, they're dependent on somebody hearing that cry, scooping them up, and addressing the need. That's what happens. And in a healthy family, baby cries, someone comes, picks it up, addresses the need, and then comforts that child. And that happens a million times. Cry, scoop them up, comfort, some rocking goes on. Some kind of rocking. Cry, scoop, addressing, comforting, and that goes over and over and over and over. And there's eye contact, and there's cooing, and this touch, and this, you know, looking, and all that over and over and over and over. When that doesn't happen, the child's brain does not develop well. Hemispheres don't come together. The two hemispheres, those neural pathways don't connect well. Anyway, not time to describe all of that. But so that alarm system that's in the lower part of your brain is overdeveloped. Okay, because when your needs aren't being met, your alarm systems are going on. When you feel threatened, the alarm systems in the lower part of your brain are going off too often, and they stay lit too long. Okay, it's hard to kind of recover from that. So when you're in your lower brain too much, you're hungry too often, you're in threatening situations too much, that's overdeveloped. Okay, so the remedy for that is you need that connection. You need to relate to somebody. Somebody's supposed to, air quotes again, pick you up and comfort you. Okay? That's the middle part of your brain, relationship part of your brain. You need that before you can ever get to the upper part of your brain where you can reason. Okay? So it's regulate, relate, reason. 1, 2, 3. Regulate, relate, reason. And it has to come in that order. So when a child is tantruming, they're in the lower part of their brain. They feel threatened. They feel scared. They feel angry. Something's wrong, and they can't articulate it. And to ask them to articulate what's wrong, tell me what's the matter, or try to engage them in a conversation about what's wrong with you know, what's causing the problem is a waste of time, because they can't. Any more than the baby crying can tell you what's going on. Because they don't have access to their upper brain. Okay? They can't do it right then. So all you can really do is try to calm a child who's tantruming. Breathe with them. Calm them down a little bit. Try to make some eye contact. Relate to them. Just, and make sure, you know, that tantruming child feels safe. Hey, you're okay.
Wow.
Hey, you're okay. Hey, you're okay. Get some eye contact. You're all right. Hey, hang on a second. You want to drink water?
Wow, you almost talk to them like they're a baby.
Almost. I mean, don't insult them, but hey, hang on. I know, but no, I hear what you're saying.
You can't. It's hard not to see the similarities.
Right, but hey, kiddo.
Right.
Dude, hang on a second. Just not trying to solve anything. Don't ask them what happened. Just hold up here a second. Drink water. Hydration, really important. You also can't cry and swallow at the same time. So, hey, dude, drink water. And now we're talking a little bit, but we're not problem solving. Just, I'm right here with you. I'm right here. I'm right here. You may not say it, but you're right here, hon. Right here. Now, dude, you're upset. Yeah. Well, you want to tell me what's going on? See how, 1, 2, 3. You can't just, what's going on? Just, man, so you got to regulate, and then you relate, and then you reason. But it's going to take many minutes. You know that I did that really fast, but it's going to take some time to do that. But the question in the child's mind is first: am I safe? Number one, am I safe? Number two: am I loved? Regulate, relate. Am I safe? Am I loved? What can I learn? 1, 2, 3. Am I safe? Am I loved? What can I learn? And so you've got to go through those steps, and they have to address all three of those things in that order. And if you do that, again, hear the compassion in that. I don't care why the kid is crying. I don't care at this moment. I don't care the why. I don't care. I just want that kid to know that they are safe. See, there's no judgment on it. kids having a tantrum, I don't want that either. But that's not what I'm addressing right now. I just want that kid to know they're safe, and I just want that kid to know that I care about them. And we're going to get to the problem because we need to solve it. That kid just hit somebody. I'm not happy about that. But right this minute, I need that child to know that they are safe. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to keep them safe. And I need that child to know that they matter to me. Now, from there, hey, kiddo, we don't throw things. We don't hurt people. We don't, you know, then you can get to, because I've just shown you respect. I've just shown you that you matter. And listen, you apply that to somebody else. You need to show them respect. See how it's a different, again, I'm not coming at them with the same energy they came at with me.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It makes beautiful sense. It's like, I can't help but think of this like a three-story home, just a three-story mm-hmm. building. You're down mm-hmm. on the foundation. Mm-hmm. Well, this is where we don't know much about anything. All we mm-hmm. know is we're alive.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I don't even know if I'm, you know, you don't know much of anything. This is just mm-hmm. your primitive roots. Mm-hmm. And here you are. Over time, you hope to develop the next couple levels. But in order to climb the stairs up to the next level, mm-hmm. which is feeling like you're loved, relate mm-hmm. is what you call it,
mm-hmm.
that you're cared for enough. Mm-hmm. You have to finish the floor on that level right. in order for you to stand there and look down and see, okay, well, that was where I was. Here I am. I'm actually cared for. And then you have to finish building the next level, mm-hmm. the floors for the next level, that you can actually stand up there in the third story and look down and reason.
That's
like, ah, I see. Okay. From here, I can see the whole problem. But down there, I was just concerned with, am I even cared for?
That's right.
And you have to develop those as these children mm-hmm. grow. And if you
yes.
don't, they just aren't there.
That's right.
But and you then, have a darn good foundation that you can always resort back to and
absolutely.
Freak out.
Exactly. And then you meet adults. Same thing. They don't feel safe and they don't feel loved and they don't have that foundation. So same thing. So it's not just a child thing or, you know, little one thing. It's adults too. And any one of us can slip into that I need to go back to feeling safe. I need to go back. We call that trauma brain. When you slip into your lower brain.
Yes.
You can slip into that.
That's a fascinating thing to see.
If you feel threatened, something happens and you feel threatened, you can slip into lower brain real quick.
Uh-huh.
Real quick. In anything that makes you feel scared, surprised, afraid, threatened, you can slip into that and lose your upper brain real quick. I'll tell you my. Do I have
Please
time for
do.
A story?
Of course
I don't know how
you
long,
do.
I feel like we've been talking.
I don't
talking
exactly
for,
know how long we've been going either. I can't quite see it from here, but it's okay. going great.
Okay, I'll tell you my favorite trauma brain story. It's about me because I wouldn't tell anybody else's trauma, so I'll tell you mine, and it's embarrassing, and I'll tell you anyway. When I was coming down to college, Illinois Wesleyan University in 19, none of your business. I was coming down with my friend Lisa, shout out to Lisa, to freshman orientation. And so you got to look good. I had my best outfit in the back seat of Lisa's dad's yellow Buick. Okay, so we're heading down old 66. That'll also date me. We're heading down old 66, heading to Wesleyan. And we stopped at the four-way stop at Shenoa. And again, best outfit in the backseat of the car, super jazz. We're going to meet boys. So it's going to be so exciting. So we get to that four-way stop, and the engine of the yellow Buick bursts into flames. Threat, right? I go into my lower brain, survival mode, fight, flight, freeze, right? And Lisa and I both chose flight. She jumps out of the car on one side. I jump out of the car on the other. Run away from the threat, right? Run away from the flaming vehicle. And I got 4 or 5 steps away from the car. And Paul, somewhere in my traumatized brain, bubbled up the thought, oh, my best outfit is in that car. I turned around, went back to the burning car. And you think I'm going to say, took the clothes out. Mm-mm. No, this is trauma brain. This is a special kind of stupid. I went back to the car and locked the door like someone's going to break into a burning car and steal my outfit.
Whoa.
That's some special stupid, right, Paul? That's dumb. But that's trauma brain. I had no access to my upper thinking brain. None. Zero. Crickets. Nothing. Nothing. If someone had been watching me, they'd have been like, that is one stupid girl. And they'd have been right. I mean, how dumb. That's not good. That girl's not going to Wesleyan. No, there's been a mistake, right? But in that moment, because I was threatened, because I was scared, I was completely in my lower brain, and I couldn't come up with a good thought, right? That was survival. I don't know what that was. That's trauma brain. And you can fall into that at any time, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I could quickly recover, okay, because it was a moment. I had a traumatic moment. I didn't live in that. But people have, others have moments like that often, mm-hmm. okay? Chronic poverty, domestic violence, chronic stress, that it's harder for them to kind of bounce back. That's resilience, right? So that they have a harder time with that. And they, again, overdeveloped lower brain, underdeveloped upper brain. Mm-hmm. It makes sense? So it's just
perfect
more
sense.
Difficult. Yeah.
It is so fascinating. You mm-hmm. paint this picture so clearly of a complex thing, mm-hmm. the brain levels, but you paint it so well and it makes so much sense. I can think back to a lot of times in my life where I've experienced someone who I previously thought was very rational, mm-hmm. but something comes up that brings them back into that trauma brain, which brings them back down to floor number one, mm-hmm. where they can no longer think rationally and mm-hmm. they start doing weird stuff. Yeah. They start acting like, and this is really interesting, mm-hmm. you can almost laugh because it seems so absurd.
Yeah.
You see someone who's had it together. They're a normal, rational mm-hmm. person. All of a sudden, someone says something about, who knows, maybe their grandma or something says, mm-hmm. hey, you put on some weight. All of a sudden, they turn into a little kid, and it's like, whoa, what's happening? Mm-hmm. You're acting erratic. Like, this is crazy.
Yes.
That can happen.
Yep.
And it's really interesting. And then also mm-hmm. when someone has something that they're holding on to that they really haven't addressed properly. Mm-hmm. They like to not acknowledge it, not think about it. They like to live their life in a fog. They kind of know it's there, but as long as they're mm-hmm. not addressing it, they're okay for the mm-hmm. most part. But it's this like sharp, pokey thing. And every once in a while, someone can kind of push them up against that, mm-hmm. maybe give them a little prick a little bit. And mm-hmm. then this is a really interesting strategy that I've read about. They will oftentimes say something so harsh to that person when they've unintentionally pushed them into that thing, so mm-hmm. harsh that they won't dare push them into it again.
Yeah.
And it takes a special kind of person, someone like yourself, I would imagine, to say, hey, I'm gonna push you into that thing and we're going to look at it and see it's not mm-hmm. this big scary thing. And then it's not going to be there ever again.
Yeah,
it's just the topic of psychology. Speaking with you is mm-hmm. really fascinating. And we could go do a whole nother podcast, I'm sure. And maybe we will. But for the interest of time and for the interest of the viewers, I'll say let's go ahead and wrap this conversation up. But it has been riveting.
It's been
amazing. And I've really enjoyed your time. Your insights are fantastic. What you do is absolutely fantastic.
Well, the Baby Fold's an amazing place.
Right. Yeah, you told me beforehand. You can't take the credit for anything. It's the organization that's incredible.
It really is amazing. I work with the staff there. Oh, amazing people. Just keeps getting better. I've never been more proud of the work we've been doing.
Is there anything you'd like to say before we go ahead and wrap this thing up?
I hope that your listeners have a Merry Christmas.
All right. There we go. Okay. And for everyone watching and listening to this episode of the Paul Garcia Show, thank you very much. That was Lori Boltemeyer with the Baby Fold. Great conversation. Again, thank you so much. And thank you to everyone for watching and listening. Be sure to like this video, leave a comment, and subscribe to my pages on Facebook, YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. And to support this show, you can go on patreon.com/PaulGarcia. And you can, for just $1 a month, get access to a whole bunch of nice things, and it really helps the show. And if you want to be a sponsor of the show or to have a commercial made for your business, go ahead and email me at info@thepaulgarciashow.com. Until next time, God bless and have a great week. Thank you for watching and listening.